Dr. Bauerstein remained in the background, his grave bearded face unchanged. Dr. Wilkins was the spokesman for the two. He addressed himself to John.
Mr. Cavendish, I should like your consent to a post-mortem.
Is that necessary?
Asked John gravely. A spasm of pain crossed his face.
Absolutely, said Dr. Bauerstein.
You mean by that?
That neither Dr. Wilkins nor myself could give a death certificate under the circumstances.
John bent his head.
In that case, I have no alternative but to agree.
Thank you, said Dr. Wilkins briskly. We propose that it should take place tomorrow night, or rather, tonight.
And he glanced at the daylight.
Under the circumstances, I'm afraid an inquest can hardly be avoided. These formalities are necessary, but I beg that you won't distress yourselves.
There was a pause, and then Dr. Bauerstein drew two keys from his pocket and handed them to John.
These are the keys of the two rooms. I have locked them, and in my opinion, they would be better kept locked for the present.
The doctors then departed. I had been turning over an idea in my head, and I felt that the moment had now come to broach it. Yet I was a little chary of doing so. John, I knew, had a horror of any kind of publicity, and was an easy-going optimist who preferred never to meet trouble halfway. It might be difficult to convince him of the soundness of my plan. Lawrence, on the other hand, being less conventional and having more imagination, I felt I might count upon as an ally. There was no doubt that the moment had come for me to take the lead. John, I said, I'm going to ask you something.
Well?
You remember my speaking of my friend Poirot, the Belgian who's here. He has been a most famous detective.
Yes?
I want you to let me call him in, to investigate this matter.
What? Now? Before the post-mortem?
Yes, time is an advantage if there has been foul play.
Rubbish!
Cried Lawrence angrily.
In my opinion, the whole thing is a mare's nest of Bauersteins. Wilkins hadn't an idea of such a thing until Bauerstein put it into his head. But like all specialists, Bauerstein's got a bee in his bonnet. Poisons are his hobby, so of course he sees them everywhere.
I confess that I was surprised by Lawrence's attitude. He was so seldom vehement about anything. John hesitated.
I can't feel as you do, Lawrence,
he said at last.
I'm inclined to give Hastings a free hand, though I should prefer to wait a bit.
We don't want any unnecessary scandal.
No, no,
I cried eagerly. You need have no fear of that. Poirot is discretion itself.
Very well, then. Have it your own way. I'll leave it in your hands. Though, if it is as we suspect, it seems a clear enough case. God forgive me if I'm wronging him.
I looked at my watch. It was 6 o'clock. I determined to lose no time. 5 minutes' delay, however, I allowed myself. I spent it in ransacking the library until I discovered a medical book which gave a description of strychnine poisoning. Chapter 4. Poirot Investigates. The house which the Belgians occupied in the village was quite close to the park gates. One could save time by taking a narrow path through the long grass which cut off the detours of the winding drive. So I, accordingly, went that way. I had nearly reached the lodge when my attention was arrested by the running figure of a man approaching me. It was Mr. Inglethorpe. Where had he been? How did he intend to explain his absence? He accosted me eagerly.
My God, this is terrible! My poor wife, I have only just heard.
Where have you been? I asked.
Denby kept me late last night. It was 1 o'clock before we'd finished. Then I found that I had forgotten the latch key after all. I didn't want to rouse the household, so Denby gave me a bed.
How did you hear the news? I asked.
Wilkins knocked Denby up to tell him. My poor Emily. She was so self-sacrificing. Such a noble character. She overtaxed her strength.
A wave of revulsion swept over me. What a consummate hypocrite the man was. I must hurry on, I said, thankful that he did not ask me whither I was bound. In a few minutes I was knocking at the door of Leastways' cottage. Getting no answer, I repeated my summons impatiently. A window above me was cautiously opened, and Poirot himself looked out. He gave an exclamation of surprise at seeing me. In a few brief words, I explained the tragedy that had occurred and that I wanted his help.
"Wait, my friend. I will let you in, and you shall recount to me the affair whilst I dress."
In a few moments he had unbarred the door, and I followed him up to his room. There he installed me in a chair, and I related the whole story, keeping back nothing and omitting no circumstance, however insignificant, whilst he himself made a careful and deliberate toilette. I told him of my awakening, of Mrs. Inglethorpe's dying words, of her husband's absence, of the quarrel the day before, of the scrap of conversation between Mary and her mother-in-law that I had overheard, of the former quarrel between Mrs. Inglethorpe and Evelyn Howard, and of the latter's innuendos. I was hardly as clear as I could wish. I repeated myself several times, and occasionally had to go back to some detail that I had forgotten. Poirot smiled kindly on me.
"The mind is confused. Is it not so? Take time, mon ami. You are agitated. You are excited. It is but natural. Presently, when we are calmer, we will arrange the facts neatly, each in his proper place. We will examine and reject. Those of importance we will put on one side. Those of no importance, poof."
He screwed up his cherub-like face and puffed comically enough.
"Blow them away."
"That's all very well," I objected. "But how are you going to decide what is important and what isn't? That always seems the difficulty to me." Poirot shook his head energetically. He was now arranging his moustache with exquisite care.
"Not so. Voyons. One fact leads to another. So we continue. Does the next fit in with that?" "Merveille." "Good. We can proceed. This next little fact, no? Ah, that is curious. There is something missing. A link in the chain that is not there. We examine, we search. And that little curious fact, that possibly paltry little detail that will not tally, we put it here."
He made an extravagant gesture with his hand.
"It is significant. It is tremendous."
"Yes."
"Ah."
Poirot shook his foreigner so fiercely at me that I quailed before it.
"Beware. Peril to the detective who says it is so small it does not matter. It will not agree. I will forget it. That way lies confusion. Everything matters."
"I know. You always told me that. That's why I have gone into all the details of this thing, whether they seem to me relevant or not."
"And I am pleased with you, and you have given me the facts faithfully. Of the order in which you present them, I say nothing truly. It is deplorable. But I make allowances. You are upset. To that, I attribute the circumstance that you have omitted one fact of paramount importance."
"What is that?" I asked.
"You have not told me if Mrs. Inglethorpe ate well last night."
I stared at him. Surely the war had affected that little man's brain. He was carefully engaged in brushing his coat before putting it on, and seemed wholly engrossed in the task. "I don't remember," I said. "And anyway, I don't see..."
"You don't see? But it is of the first importance."
"I can't see why," I said, rather nettled. "As far as I can remember, she didn't eat much. She was obviously upset, and it had taken her appetite away. That was only natural."
"Yes,"
said Poirot thoughtfully.
"It was only natural."
He opened a drawer and took out a small dispatch case, then turned to me.
"Now I'm ready. We will proceed to the chateau and study matters on the spot. Excuse me, mon ami, you dress in haste, and your tie's on one side. Permit me."
With a deft gesture, he rearranged it.
"So he est. Now, shall we start?"
We hurried up the village and turned in at the lodge gates. Poirot stopped for a moment and gazed sorrowfully over the beautiful expanse of park still glittering with morning dew.
"So beautiful, so beautiful, and yet the poor family plunged in sorrow.
prostrated with grief.
He looked at me keenly as he spoke, and I was aware that I rendered under his prolonged gaze. Was the family prostrated by grief? Was the sorrow at Mrs. Inglethorpe's death so great? I realized that there was an emotional lack in the atmosphere. The dead woman had not the gift of commanding love. Her death was a shock and a distress, but she would not be passionately regretted. Poirot seemed to follow my thoughts. He nodded his head gravely.
"No, you are right," he said. "It is not as though there was a blood tie. She has been kind and generous to the Cavendishes, but she was not their own mother. Blood tells. Always remember that. Blood tells."
"Poirot," I said, "I wish you would tell me why you wanted to know if Mrs. Inglethorpe ate well last night. I have been turning it over in my mind, but I can't see how it has anything to do with the matter." He was silent for a minute or two as we walked along, but finally he said,
"I do not mind telling you, though, as you know, it is not my habit to explain until the end is reached. The present contention is that Mrs. Inglethorpe died of strychnine poisoning, presumably administered in her coffee."
"Yes?"
"Well, what time was the coffee served?"
"About 8 o'clock."
"Therefore she drank it between then and 8:30. Certainly not much later.
Well,
strychnine is a fairly rapid poison. Its effects would be felt very soon, probably in about an hour. Yet in Mrs. Inglethorpe's case, the symptoms do not manifest themselves until 5 o'clock the next morning. 9 hours. But a heavy meal, taking at about the same time as the poison, might retard its effects, though hardly to that extent. Still, it is a possibility to be taken into account. But, according to you, she ate very little for supper, and yet the symptoms do not develop until early the next morning. Now, that is a curious circumstance, my friend. Something may arise at the autopsy to explain it. In the meantime, remember it."
As we neared the house, John came out and met us. His face looked weary and haggard.
"This is a very dreadful business, Monsieur Poirot," he said. "Hastings has explained to you that we are anxious for no publicity."
"I comprehend perfectly."
"You see, it is only suspicion so far. We have nothing to go upon."
"Precisely. It is a matter of precaution only."
John turned to me, taking out his cigarette case and lighting a cigarette as he did so.
"You know that fellow Inglethorpe is back?"
"Yes, I met him." John flung the match into an adjacent flower bed, a proceeding which was too much for Poirot's feelings. He retrieved it and buried it neatly.
"Jolly difficult to know how to treat him."
"That difficulty will not exist long,"
pronounced Poirot quietly. John looked puzzled, not quite understanding the portent of this cryptic saying. He handed the two keys which Dr. Bauerstein had given him to me.
"Show Monsieur Poirot everything he wants to see."
"The rooms are locked?"
asked Poirot.
"Dr. Bauerstein considered it advisable."
Poirot nodded thoughtfully.
"Then he's very sure. Well, that simplifies matters for us."
We went up together to the room of the tragedy. For convenience, I penned a plan of the room and the principal articles of furniture in it. Poirot looked the door on the inside and proceeded to a minute inspection of the room. He darted from one object to the other with the agility of a grasshopper. I remained by the door, fearing to obliterate any clues. Poirot, however, did not seem grateful to me for my forbearance.
What have you, my friend?" he cried, "that you remain there like, how do you say it? Ah, yes, the stuck pig."
I explained that I was afraid of obliterating any footmarks.
"Footmarks? But what an idea! There has already been particularly an army in the room. What footmarks are we likely to find? No, come here and aid me in my search. I will put down my little case until I need it."
He did so on the round table by the window, but it was an ill-advised proceeding, for the top of it being loose, it tilted up and precipitated the dispatch case on the floor.
Eh, voilà un table,
cried Poirot.
Ah, my friend, one may live in a big house and yet have no comfort.
After which piece of moralizing he resumed his search. A small purple dispatch case, with a key in the lock, on the writing table engaged his attention for some time. He took out the key from the lock and passed it to me to inspect. I saw nothing peculiar, however. It was an ordinary key of the Yale type, with a bit of twisted wire through the handle. Next, he examined the framework of the door we had broken in, assuring himself that the bolt had really been shot. Then he went to the door opposite, leading into Cynthia's room. That door was also bolted, as I had stated. However, he went to the length of unbolting it and opening and shutting it several times. This he did with the utmost precaution against making any noise. Suddenly, something in the bolt itself seemed to rivet his attention. He examined it carefully and then, nimbly whipping out a pair of small forceps from his case, he drew out some minute particle which he carefully sealed up in a tiny envelope. On the chest of drawers there was a tray with a spirit lamp and a small saucepan on it. A small quantity of a dark fluid remained in the saucepan, and an empty cup and saucer that had been drunk out of stood near it. I wondered how I could have been so unobservant as to overlook this. Here was a clue worth having. Poirot delicately dipped his finger into liquid and tasted it gingerly. He made a grimace.
Cocoa, with, I think, rum in it.
He passed on the debris on the floor, where the table by the bed had been overturned. A reading lamp, some books, matches, a bunch of keys, and the crushed fragments of a coffee cup lay scattered about.
Aha! This is curious, said Poirot.
I must confess that I see nothing particularly curious about it.
You do not? Observe the lamp. The chimney is broken in two places. They lie there as they fell. But see, the coffee cup is absolutely smashed to powder.
Well, I said wearily, I suppose someone must have stepped on it.
Exactly, said Poirot in an odd voice. Someone stepped on it.
He rose from his knees and walked slowly across to the mantelpiece, where he stood abstractedly fingering the ornaments and straightening them, a trick of his when he was agitated.
Mon ami,
he said, turning to me,
somebody stepped on that cup, grinding it to powder, and the reason they did so was either because it contained strychnine or, which is far more serious, because it did not contain strychnine.
I made no reply. I was bewildered, but I knew that it was no good asking him to explain. In a moment or two he roused himself and went on with his investigations. He picked up the bunch of keys from the floor, and twirling them round in his fingers, finally selected one, very bright and shining, which he tried in the lock of the purple dispatch case. It fitted, and he opened the box, but after a moment's hesitation, closed and relocked it, and slipped the bunch of keys as well as the key that had originally stood in the lock into his own pocket.
I have no authority to go through these papers, but it should be done at once.
He then made a very careful examination of the drawers of the washstand. Crossing the room to the left-hand window, a round stain hardly visible on the dark brown carpet seemed to interest him particularly. He went down on his knees examining it minutely, even going so far as to smell it. Finally, he poured a few drops of the cocoa into a test tube, sealing it up carefully. His next proceeding was to take out a little notebook.
We have found in this room,
he said, writing busily,
6 points of interest. Shall I enumerate them, or will you?
Oh, you, I replied hastily.
Very well, then. 1, a coffee cup that has been ground into powder. 2, a dispatch case with a key in the lock. 3, a stain on the floor.
That may have been done some time ago, I interrupted.
No, for it is still perceptibly damp and smells of coffee. 4, a fragment of some dark green fabric, only a thread or two, but recognizable.
Ah, I cried, that was what you sealed up in the envelope.
Yes, it may turn out to be a piece of one of Mrs. Ingthorpe's own dresses, and quite unimportant. We shall see. 5. This.
With a dramatic gesture, he pointed to a large splash of candle grease on the floor by the writing table.
It must have been done since yesterday, otherwise a good housemaid would have at once removed it with blotting paper and a hot iron. One of my best hats once, but that is not to the point.
It was very likely done last night. We were very agitated. Or perhaps Mrs. Ingthorpe herself dropped her candle.
You brought only one candle into the room?
Yes, Lawrence Cavendish was carrying it, but he was very upset. He seemed to see something over here. I indicated the mantelpiece. That absolutely paralyzed him.
That is interesting, said Poirot quickly. Yes, it is suggestive.
His eyes sweeping the whole length of the wall.
But it was not his candle that made this great patch, for you perceive that this is white grease, whereas Monsieur Lovren's candle, which is still on the dressing table, is pink. On the other hand, Mrs. Ingthorpe had no candlestick in the room, only a reading lamp.
Then, I said, what do you deduce? To which my friend only made a rather irritating reply, urging me to use my own natural faculties. And the sixth point? I asked. I suppose it is the sample of cocoa.
No,
said Poirot thoughtfully.
I might have included that in the sixth, but I did not. No, the sixth point I will keep to myself for the present.
He looked quickly round the room.
There is nothing more to be done here, I think, unless...
He stared earnestly and long at the dead ashes in the grate.
The fire burns and it destroys. By chance, there might be... Let us see.
Deftly, on hands and knees, he began to saw the ashes from the grate into the fender, handling them with the greatest caution. Suddenly, he gave a faint exclamation.
The forceps, Hastings!
I quickly handed them to him, and with skill he extracted a small piece of half-charred paper.
There, mon ami,
he cried.
What do you think of that?
I scrutinized the fragment. This is an exact reproduction of it. I was puzzled. It was unusually thick, quite unlike ordinary notepaper. Suddenly, an idea struck me. Poirot, I cried. This is a fragment of a will.
Exactly.
I looked up at him sharply. You're not surprised?
No,
he said gravely.
I expected it.
I relinquished the piece of paper and watched him put it away in his case, with the same methodical care that he bestowed on everything. My brain was in a whirl. What was this complication of a will? Who had destroyed it? The person who had left the candle grease on the floor? Obviously. But how had anyone gained admission? All the doors had been bolted on the inside.
Now, my friend, said Poirot briskly, we will go. I should like to ask a few questions of the parlourmaid. Dorcas, her name is it not?
We passed through Alfred Inglethorpe's room, and Poirot delayed long enough to make a brief but fairly comprehensive examination of it. We went out through that door, locking both it and that of Mrs. Inglethorpe's room as before. I took him down to the boudoir which he had expressed a wish to see, and went myself in search of Dorcas. When I returned with her, however, the boudoir was empty. Poirot, I cried, where are you?
I am here, my friend.
He had stepped outside the French window and was standing, apparently lost in admiration, before the various shaped flower beds.
Admirable,
he murmured.
Admirable? What symmetry! Observe that crescent and those diamonds. Their neatness rejoices the eye. The spacing of the plants also is perfect. It has been recently done, is it not so?
Yes, I believe they were at it yesterday afternoon. But come in, Dorcas is here.
Eh bien. Do not grudge me a moment's satisfaction of the eye.
Yes, but this affair is more important.
And how do you know these fine begonias are not of equal importance?
I shrugged my shoulders. There was really no arguing with him if he chose to take that line.
You do not agree. But such things have been. Well, we will come in and interview the brave Dorcas.
Dorcas was standing in the boudoir, her hands folded in front of her, and her grey hair rose in stiff waves under her white cap. She was the very model and picture of a good old-fashioned servant. In her attitude towards Poirot, she was inclined to be suspicious, but he soon broke down her defences. He drew forward a chair.
"Pray be seated, mademoiselle." "Thank you, sir. You have been with your mistress many years, is it not so?" 10 years, sir." "That is a long time, and very faithful service. You were much attached to her, were you not?" "She was a very good mistress to me, sir." "Then you will not object to answering a few questions. I put them to you with Mrs. Cavendish's full approval."
"Oh, certainly, sir." "Then I will begin by asking you about the events of yesterday afternoon. Your mistress had a quarrel?"
"Yes, sir. But I don't know that I ought—"
Dorcas hesitated. Poirot looked at her keenly.
"My good Dorcas, it is necessary that I should know every detail of that quarrel as fully as possible. Do not think that you are betraying your mistress's secrets. Your mistress lies dead, and it is necessary that we should know all if we are to avenge her. Nothing can bring her back to life, but we do hope, if there has been foul play, to bring the murderer to justice."
"Amen to that," said Dorcas fiercely. "And naming no names, there is one in this house that none of us could ever abide. And an ill day it was when first he darkened the threshold."
Poirot waited for her indignation to subside, and then resuming his business-like tone, he asked,
"Now, as to this quarrel, what is the first you heard of it?"
"Well, sir, I happened to be going along the hall outside yesterday."
"What time was that?"
"I couldn't say exactly, sir, but it wasn't tea-time by a long way. Perhaps 4 o'clock, or it may have been a bit later. Well, sir, as I said, I happened to be passing along when I heard voices very loud and angry in here. I didn't exactly mean to listen, but, well, there it is." I stopped. The door was shut, but the mistress was speaking very sharp and clear, and I heard what she said quite plainly. "You have lied to me and deceived me," she said. I didn't hear what Mr. Inglethorpe replied. He spoke a good bit lower than she did, but she answered, "How dare you? I have kept you and clothed you and fed you. You owe everything to me, and this is how you repay me, by bringing disgrace upon our name." Again, I didn't hear what he said, but she went on, "Nothing that you can say will make any difference. I see my duty clearly. My mind is made up. You need not think that any fear of publicity or scandal between husband and wife will deter me." Then I thought I heard them coming out, so I went off quickly.
"You are sure it was Mr. Inglethorpe's voice you heard?"
"Oh, yes, sir. Whose else's could it be?"
"Well, what happened next?"
"Later I came back to the hall, but it was all quiet. At 5 o'clock Mrs. Inglethorpe rang the bell and told me to bring her a cup of tea, nothing to eat, to the boudoir. She was looking dreadful, so white and upset. 'Dorcas,' she says, 'I've had a great shock.' 'I'm sorry for that, ma'am,' I says. 'You'll feel better after a nice hot cup of tea, ma'am.' She had something in her hand. I don't know if it was a letter or just a piece of paper, but it had writing on it. She kept staring at it, almost as if she couldn't believe what was written there. She whispered to herself as though she had forgotten I was there, 'These few words, and everything's changed.' And then she says to me, 'Never trust a man, Dorcas. They're not worth it.' I hurried off and got her a good strong cup of tea, and she thanked me and said she'd feel better when she'd drunk it. 'I don't know what to do,' she says. 'Scandal between husband and wife is a dreadful thing, Dorcas. I'd rather hush it up if I could.' Mrs. Cavendish came in just then, so she didn't say any more."
"She still held the letter, or whatever it was, in her hand?"
"Yes, sir."
"What would she be likely to do with it afterwards?"
"Well, I don't know, sir. I expect she would lock it up in that purple case of hers."
"Is that where she usually kept important papers?"
Yes, sir. She brought it down with her every morning and took it up every night.
When did she lose the key of it?
She missed it yesterday at lunchtime, sir, and told me to look carefully for it. She was very much put out about it.
But she had a duplicate key.
Oh, yes, sir.
Dorcas was looking very curiously at him, and, to tell the truth, so was I. What was all this about a lost key? Poirot smiled.
Never mind, Dorcas. It is my business to know things. Is this the key that was lost?
He drew from his pocket the key that he had found in the lock of the dispatched case upstairs. Dorcas' eyes looked as though they would pop out of her head.
That's it, sir, right enough. But where did you find it? I looked everywhere for it.
Ah, but you see, it was not in the same place yesterday as it was today. Now, to pass to another subject, had your mistress a dark green dress in her wardrobe?
Dorcas was rather startled by the unexpected question.
No, sir.
Are you quite sure?
Oh, yes, sir.
Has anyone else in the house got a green dress?
Dorcas reflected.
Miss Cynthia has a green evening dress.
Light or dark green?
A light green, sir. A sort of chiffon, they call it.
Ah, that is not what I want. And nobody else has anything green.
No, sir. Not that I know of.
Poirot's face did not betray a trace of whether he was disappointed or otherwise. He merely remarked,
Good. We will leave that and pass on. Have you any reason to believe that your mistress was likely to take a sleeping powder last night?
Not last night, sir. I know she didn't.
Why do you know so positively?
Because the box was empty. She took the last one 2 days ago and she didn't have any more made up.
You're quite sure of that?
Positive, sir.
Then that is cleared up. By the way, your mistress didn't ask you to sign any paper yesterday.
To sign a paper? No, sir.
When Mr. Hastings and Mr. Lawrence came in yesterday evening, they found your mistress busy writing letters. I suppose you can give me no idea to whom these letters were addressed.
I'm afraid I couldn't, sir. I was out in the evening. Perhaps Annie could tell you, though she's a careless girl. Never clear the coffee cups away last night. That's what happens when I'm not here to look after things.
Poirot lifted his hand.
Since they have been left, Dorcas, leave them a little longer, I pray you. I should like to examine them.
Very well, sir.
What time did you go out last evening?
About 6 o'clock, sir.
Thank you, Dorcas. This is all I have to ask you.
He rose and strolled to the window.
I have been admiring these flower beds. How many gardeners are employed here, by the way?
Only 3 now, sir.
5 we had before the war, when it was kept as a gentleman's place should be.
I wish you could have seen it then, sir. A fair sight it was, but now there's only old Manning and young William and a new-fashioned woman gardener in breeches and such like. These are dreadful times.
The good times will come again, Dorcas. At least, we hope so. Now, will you send Annie to me here?
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir.
How did you know that Mrs. Inglethorpe took sleeping powders? I asked in lively curiosity as Dorcas left the room. And about the lost key and the duplicate?
One thing at a time. As to the sleeping powders, I knew by this.
He suddenly produced a small cardboard box, such as chemists use for powders.
Where did you find it?
In the washstand drawer in Mrs. Inglethorpe's bedroom. It was number 6 of my catalogue.
But I suppose, as the last powder was taken 2 days ago, it is not of much importance.
Probably not. But do you notice anything that strikes you as peculiar about this box?
I examined it closely. No, I can't say that I do.
Look at the label.
I read the label carefully. 1 powder to be taken at bedtime, if required. Mrs. Inglethorpe. No, I see nothing unusual.
Not the fact that there is no chemist's name.
Ah, I exclaimed.
To be sure, that is odd. Have you ever known a chemist to send out a box like that? without his printed name?
No, I can't say that I have. I was becoming quite excited, but Poirot damped my ardour by remarking,
Yet the explanation is quite simple, so do not intrigue yourself, my friend.
An audible creaking proclaimed the approach of Annie, so I had no time to reply. Annie was a fine, strapping girl, and was evidently labouring under intense excitement, mingled with a certain ghoulish enjoyment of the tragedy. Poirot came to the point at once with a business-like briskness.
I sent for you, Annie, because I thought you might be able to tell me something about the letters Mrs. Inglethorpe wrote last night. How many were there? And can you tell me any of the names and addresses?
Annie considered.
There were four letters, sir. One was to Miss Howard, and one was to Mr. Wells, the lawyer, and the other two I don't think I remember, sir. Oh, yes, one was to Ross's, the caretakers in Tadminster. The other one I don't remember.
Think,
urged Poirot. Annie racked her brains in vain.
I'm sorry, sir, but it's clean gone. I don't think I can have noticed it.
It does not matter,
said Poirot, not betraying any sign of disappointment.
Now, I want to ask you about something else. There is a saucepan in Mrs. Inglethorpe's room with some cocoa in it. Did she have that every night?
Yes, sir, it was put in her room every evening, and she warmed it up in the night, whenever she fancied it.
What was it? Plain cocoa?
Yes, sir, made with milk, with a teaspoonful of sugar and 2 teaspoonfuls of rum in it.
Who took it to her room?
I did, sir.
Always?
Yes, sir.
At what time?
When I went to draw the curtains, as a rule, sir.
Did you bring it straight up from the kitchen, then?
No, sir. You see, there's not much room on the gas stove, so cook used to make it early, before putting the vegetables on for supper. Then I used to bring it up and put it on the table by the swing door, and take it into her room later.
The swing door is in the left wing, is it not?
Yes, sir.
And the table, is it on this side of the door, or on the farther, the servant's side?
It's this side, sir.
What time did you bring it up last night?
About 7:15, I should say, sir.
And when did you take it into Mrs. Inglethorpe's room?
When I went to shut up, sir, about 8:00. Mrs. Inglethorpe came up to bed before I had finished.
Then between 7:15 and 8:00, the cocoa was standing on the table in the left wing.
Yes, sir.
Annie had been growing redder and redder in the face, and now she blurted out unexpectedly.
And if there was salt in it, sir, it wasn't me. I never took the salt near it.
What makes you think there was salt in it?
Asked Poirot.
Seeing it on the tray, sir.
You saw some salt on the tray?
Yes, coarse kitchen salt it looked. I never noticed it when I took the tray up, but when I came to take it into the mistress's room, I saw it at once, and I suppose I ought to have taken it down again and asked cook to make some fresh. But I was in a hurry, because Dorcas was out, and I thought maybe the cocoa itself was all right, and the salt had only gone on the tray. So I dusted it off with my apron and took it in.
I had the utmost difficulty in controlling my excitement. Unknown to herself, Annie had provided us with an important piece of evidence. How she would have gaped if she had realized that her coarse kitchen salt was strychnine, one of the most deadly poisons known to mankind. I marveled at Poirot's calm. His self-control was astonishing. I awaited his next question with impatience, but it disappointed me.
When you went into Mrs. Inglethorpe's room, was the door leading into Miss Cynthia's room bolted?
Oh, yes, sir. It always was. It had never been opened.
And the door into Mr. Inglethorpe's room? Did you notice if that was bolted, too?
Annie hesitated.
I couldn't rightly say, sir. It was shut, but I couldn't say whether it was bolted or not.
When you finally left the room, did Mrs. Inglethorpe bolt the door after you?
No, sir, not then, but I expect she did later. She usually did lock it at night. The door into the passage, that is.
Did you notice any candle grease on the floor when you did the room yesterday?
Candle grease? Oh, no, sir. Mrs. Inglethorpe didn't have a candle, only a reading lamp.
Then, if there had been a large patch of candle grease on the floor, you think you would have been sure to have seen it?
Yes, sir, and I would have taken it out with a piece of blotting paper and a hot iron.
Then Poirot repeated the question he had put to Dorcas.
Did your mistress ever have a green dress?
No, sir.
Nor a mantle, nor a cape, nor a... how do you call it? A sports coat.
Not green, sir.
Nor anyone else in the house?
Annie reflected.
No, sir.
You are sure of that?
Quite sure.
Bien. This is all I want to know. Thank you very much.
With a nervous giggle, Annie took herself creakingly out of the room. My pent-up excitement burst forth. Poirot, I cried. I congratulate you. This is a great discovery.
What is a great discovery?
Why, that it was the cocoa and not the coffee that was poisoned. That explains everything. Of course, it did not take effect until the early morning, since the cocoa was only drunk in the middle of the night.
So, you think that the cocoa... Mark, well, what I say, Hastings, the cocoa contains strychnine.
Of course. That salt on the train, what else could it have been?
It might have been salt,
replied Poirot placidly. I shrugged my shoulders. If he was going to take the matter that way, it was no good arguing with him. The idea crossed my mind, not for the first time, that poor old Poirot was growing old. Privately, I thought it lucky that he had associated with him someone of a more receptive type of mind. Poirot was surveying me with quietly twinkling eyes.
You are not pleased with me, mon ami?
My dear Poirot, I said coldly, it is not for me to dictate to you. You have a right to your own opinion, just as I have to mine.
A most admirable sentiment,
remarked Poirot, rising briskly to his feet.
Now I have finished with this room. By the way, whose is the smaller desk in the corner?
Mr. Inglethorpe's.
Ah.
He tried the roll top tentatively.
Locked. Well, perhaps one of Mrs. Inglethorpe's keys would open it.
He tried several, twisting and turning them with a practised hand, and finally uttering an ejaculation of satisfaction.
Voila! It is not the key, but it will open it at a pinch.
He slid back the roll top and ran a rapid eye over the neatly filed papers. To my surprise, he did not examine them, merely remarking approvingly as he relocked the desk.
Decidedly, he is a man of method, this Mr. Inglethorpe.
A man of method was, in Poirot's estimation, the highest praise that could be bestowed on any individual. I felt that my friend was not what he had been as he rambled on discontentedly.
There was no stamps in his desk, but they might have been, mon ami? There might have been. Yes.
His eyes wandered round the room.
This boudoir has nothing more to tell us. It did not yield much, only this.
He pulled a crumpled envelope out of his pocket and tossed it over to me. It was rather a curious document. A plain, dirty-looking old envelope with a few words scrawled across it, apparently at random. The following is a facsimile of it. Chapter 5. It isn't strychnine, is it? Where did you find this? I asked Poirot in lively curiosity.
In the waste paper basket. You recognize the handwriting?
Yes, it is Mrs. Inglethorpe's. But what does it mean? Poirot shrugged his shoulders.
I cannot say, but it is suggestive.
A wild idea flashed across me. Was it possible that Mrs. Inglethorpe's mind was deranged? Had she some fantastic idea of demoniacal possession? And if that were so, was it not also possible that she might have taken her own life? I was about to expound these theories to Poirot when his own words distracted me.
Come, he said, now to examine the coffee cups.
My dear Poirot, what on earth is the good of that, now that we know about the cocoa?
Oh la la, that miserable cocoa,
cried Poirot flippantly. He laughed with apparent enjoyment, raising his arms to heaven in mock despair, in what I could not but consider the worst possible taste. And anyway, I said, with increasing coldness, as Mrs. Inglethorpe took her coffee upstairs with her, I do not see what you expect to find unless you consider it likely that we shall discover a packet of strychnine on the coffee tray. Poirot was sobered at once.
Come, come, my friend,
he said, slipping his arms through mine.
Ne vous fâchez pas. Allow me to interest myself in my coffee cups, and I will respect your cocoa. There. Is it a bargain?
He was so queasily humorous that I was forced to laugh, and we went together to the drawing-room, where the coffee cups and tray remained undisturbed as we had left them. Farrell made me recapitulate the scene of the night before, listening very carefully and verifying the position of the various cups.
So Mrs. Cavendish stood by the tray and poured out. Yes. Then she came across the window where you sat with Mademoiselle Cynthia. Yes. Here are the three cups. And the cup on the mantelpiece, half drunk, that would be Mr. Lawrence Cavendish's. And the one on the tray?
John Cavendish's. I saw him put it down there.
Good. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. But where, then, is the cup of Mr. Inglethorpe?
He does not take coffee.
And then all are accounted for. One moment, my friend.
With infinite care, he took a drop or two from the grounds in each cup, sealing them up in separate test tubes, tasting each in turn as he did so. His physiognomy underwent a curious change, an expression gathered there that I can only describe as half puzzled and half relieved.
"Bien," he said at last, "it is evident. I had an idea, but clearly I was mistaken. Yes, altogether I was mistaken. Yes, it is strange, but no matter."
And with a characteristic shrug, he dismissed whatever it was that was worrying him from his mind. I could have told him from the beginning that this obsession of his over the coffee was bound to end in a blind alley, but I restrained my tongue. After all, though he was old, Poirot had been a great man in his day.
"Breakfast is ready," said John Cavendish, coming in from the hall. "You will breakfast with us, Monsieur Poirot."
Poirot acquiesced. I observed John. Already he was almost restored to his normal self. The shock of the events of the last night had upset him temporarily, but his equable poise soon swung back to the normal. He was a man of very little imagination, in sharp contrast with his brother, who had perhaps too much. Ever since the early hours of the morning, John had been hard at work, sending telegrams. One of the first had gone to Evelyn Howard, writing notices for the papers, and generally occupying himself with the melancholy duties that a death entails.
"May I ask how things are proceeding?" he said.
"Do your investigations point to my mother having died a natural death, or
must we prepare ourselves for the worst?"
"I think, Mr. Cavendish," said Poirot gravely, "that you would do well not to bore yourself up with any false hopes. Can you tell me the views of the other members of the family?"
"My brother Lawrence is convinced that we are making a fuss over nothing. He says that everything points to its being a simple case of heart failure."
"He does he? That is very interesting, very interesting,"
murmured Poirot softly.
"And Mrs. Cavendish?"
A faint cloud passed over John's face.
"I have not the least idea what my wife's views on the subject are."
The answer brought a momentary stiffness in its train. John broke the rather awkward silence by saying with a slight effort,
"I told you, didn't I, that Mr. Inglethorpe has returned?"
Poirot bent his head.
"It's an awkward position for all of us. Of course one has to treat him as usual, but hang it all, one's gorge does rise at sitting down to eat with a possible murderer."
Poirot nodded sympathetically.
"I quite understand. It is a very difficult situation for you, Mr. Cavendish. I would like to ask you one question. Mr. Inglethorpe's reason for not returning last night was, I believe, that he had forgotten the latch-key. Is that so?"
"Yes."
"I suppose you are quite sure that the latch-key was forgotten, that he did not take it after all?"
"I have no idea. I never thought of looking. We always keep it in the hall drawer. I'll go and see if it's there now."
Farrell held up his hand with a feigned smile.
No, Mr. Cavendish, it is too late now. I'm certain that you would find it. If Mr. Inglethorpe did take it, he has had ample time to replace it by now."
"But do you think—"
"I think nothing. If anyone had chanced to look this morning before his return and see there, it would have been a valuable point in his favour. That is all."
John looked perplexed.
"Do not worry," said Poirot smoothly. "I assure you that you need not let it trouble you. Since you are so kind, let us go and have some breakfast."
Everyone was assembled in the dining room. Under the circumstances, we were naturally not a cheerful party. The reaction after a shock is always trying, and I think we were all suffering from it. Decorum and good breeding naturally enjoyed that our demeanour should be much as usual, yet I could not help wondering if this self-control were really a matter of great difficulty. There were no red eyes, no signs of secretly indulged grief. I felt that I was right in my opinion that Dorcas was the person most affected by the personal side of the tragedy. I passed over Alfred Inglethorpe, who acted the bereaved widower in a manner that I felt to be disgusting in his hypocrisy. Did he know that we suspected him, I wondered. Surely he could not be unaware of the fact, conceal it as we would. Did he feel some secret stirring of fear, or was he confident that his crime would go unpunished? Surely the suspicion in the atmosphere must warn him that he was already a marked man. But did everyone suspect him? What about Mrs. Cavendish? I watched her as she sat at the head of the table, graceful, composed, enigmatic. In her soft grey frock with white ruffles at the wrists falling over her slender hands, she looked very beautiful. When she chose, however, her face could be sphinx-like in its inscrutability. She was very silent, hardly opening her lips, and yet in some queer way I felt that the great strength of her personality was dominating us all. And little Cynthia, did she suspect? She looked very tired and ill, I thought. The heaviness and languor of her manner were very marked. I asked her if she were feeling ill, and she answered frankly,
"Yes, I've got the most beastly headache."
"Have another cup of coffee, mademoiselle," said Poirot solicitously. "It will revive you. It is unparalleled for the malditity."
He jumped up and took a cup.
"No sugar,"
said Cynthia, watching him as he picked up the sugar tongs.
"No sugar? You abandon it in the water, eh?"
"No, I never take it in coffee."
"Sacré,"
murmured Poirot to himself, as he brought back the replenished cup. Only I heard him, and glancing up curiously at the little man, I saw that his face was working with suppressed excitement, and his eyes were as green as a cat's. He had heard or seen something that had affected him strongly. But what was it? I do not usually label myself as dense, but I must confess that nothing out of the ordinary had attracted my attention. In another moment, the door opened, and Dorcas appeared.
"Mr. Welsh to see you, sir,"
she said to John. I remember the name as being that of the lawyer to whom Mrs. Inglethorpe had written the night before. John rose immediately.
"Show him into my study."
Then he returned to us.
"My mother's lawyer,"
he explained. And in a lower voice,
"He's also coroner, you understand. Perhaps you would like to come with me?"
We acquiesced and followed him out of the room. John strode on ahead, and I took the opportunity of